white shoes.
What's the matter, Morty?
Moral, the string.
Tension by our whole dress.
Moral, the string.
Great gowns.
Moral,
beautiful gowns.
Fashion has changed.
Moral,
no, it hasn't.
Hi, I'm Lauren Garoni.
And I'm Chelsea Fairless.
And welcome back to another Every Outfit podcast episode. Before we begin, I want to apologize if I sound weird today.
It's because you're a Republican.
Yeah, I can't keep it in any longer, guys. No, I had some dental work before recording, which was honestly rookie mistake. But I didn't think that I would be numbed, and I was numbed, and I'm coming out of it, and I might sound a little off.
You have a slight lisp, but I think it's charming.
Okay, good.
Beyond dental work, we've had a pretty cute week, or at least a cute Saturday.
That's true. On Saturday, I took Chelsea out for a high tea afternoon date at the wonderful Waldorf Astoria.
I didn't even know there was a Waldorf Astoria in Los Angeles. This was big news for me.
Yeah, Chelsea was like, you're bringing me to a made-up place. Yeah, I mean, look, guys, you can't be complacent with your work wife. It can't be podcast, merch. You have to date your work wife.
You gotta wine and dine me at the Waldorf Astoria.
I gotta champagne and mini scone you every once in a while.
Well, we've been talking for a while about how we love getting tea and we love the little sandwiches and the whole thing. And it's something that we used to do with our moms when we were kids. And I've never just gone as an adult woman with a friend before.
Yeah, I think as children, I would have thought with adult money, I would be doing high tea all the time. Couldn't tell you the last time I've been.
It was great. I also appreciated the fact that there is a piano player, but they were just playing top 40. Like, it was just like Billie Eilish and Ariana Grande and stuff. I felt like I was in Westworld or something.
Piano covers of pop songs is giving Westworld, to which when Chelsea said that to me when we were sitting down, she was like, you never watched that. I was like, I did. The first season.
I watched like the first three episodes and was like, I think I'm good.
You made the right choice. It rapidly became about the interior lives of robots, and I realized, like, I actually don't care.
After we went to tea, we went to Saks Fifth Avenue, which reopened semi-recently in the old Barney's space in Beverly Hills, which is probably our most iconic store or iconic building.
Yes. And for a long time, we wondered who would take over that space because it is so massive. For those who don't live in Los Angeles, it was a little puzzling that Saks took over the lease because they literally moved two buildings down. Can I say that on the way to Saks, I wish I had been recording all of this because we passed by a Subway sandwich shop and I'm driving Chell and she just goes, oh, that's the best Subway location in Los Angeles.
They make a great Subway sandwich at the Beverly Hills one. Maybe not the best location because there's no parking. Like, you basically have to like illegally park in front of the Subway, which is what I always do. But fire Subway.
I imagine that people's perception of us is like, we're at Maxfield's. Obviously, like, we just went to high tea, but like, we are also very lowbrow people. And Chelsea could give you a power ranking of the Subway locations of Southern California.
Absolutely.
I also wish I had been recording you when we went through Saks and your commentary of the buyer's selection.
That store is not for me. It is for the most basic luxury consumer that exists. It's not that they don't stock great brands. They do. They just edit out all of the pieces that are either flamboyant or subversive. So it's like you'll look at a rack and have no idea what the brand is actually about. Like, it made me dislike brands that I already like.
Yeah, I think the most egregious example of this was the Loewe rack, which you really would not be able to tell it was Loewe by the selection.
Yeah, because there was nothing weird. Sure, the handbag section, that was fine, but the clothes, like, very dark, very spooky, not giving. Also, nothing for like a rapper to buy in there, which is genuinely weird.
It was giving boomer housewife adjacent clientele, and which is absolutely fine, but just have a like Nordstrom space-esque place, right? Just have a corner with some weird stuff.
No, just like have something that the rapper can buy. Have like one crazy Balenciaga leather jacket that's like $40,000 or something, just for shits and giggles. Like, have those pieces.
I do notice, because Neiman Marcus and this Saks are now the same, where they reserve the basement for the beauty products, which is always a great selection. If you ever need something or a gift for someone, that's always a great place to go. But it's like, why is it in the bowels of the store?
Yeah, but at least that's the one place that we could shop.
The other problem with this Saks is they've taken a Soho House mentality. There is a restaurant, but it is for the members only.
Yeah, that's unfortunate, because the Saks restaurant, that's one thing that a lot of people that maybe wouldn't buy something in the store can, like, go to the restaurant and have lunch.
I'm sorry, every department store is obligated to have a restaurant or at least a bar. The best of which, top floor of Neiman Marcus, they have a bar with some nosh. That's all you need. Some cheese, chili, love a random assortment of noshing food. And also, it's the best people watching in Beverly Hills, because those are like the Beverly Hills regulars that stop by this bar.
The people in Saks scared me a bit.
Oh, I'm sorry. I would have held your hand. We did see Sofia Vergara and her very cute dog.
Yes, dog was on point for sure. In other news,
I think we're going to have to talk about politics again, guys. We're so sorry.
Yeah, Tim Walz is Kamala's VP pick. Seems like the general reaction has been quite positive. You sent me a text earlier this week that was just like, it's really shocking to see the Democrats winning like this. For once,
it is the most bizarre but benevolent butterfly effects I've ever experienced. Because again, guys, this is all happening because Biden's campaign insisted they do a televised debate so early. Yeah. And they shit the bed this badly. Yeah, Walz is a choice that somehow satisfies establishment Democrats and the DSA. What reality am I living in? So Walz is the governor of Minnesota. He was a congressman before that. He is also a former high school teacher. While Governor Walz put forth legislation that provided free college tuition for low-income families and free breakfast and lunch to students at participating schools in the state, he also expanded abortion access and legalized recreational marijuana. He is also the person that originally coined calling Republicans and their policies weird.
Yeah, it seems like he has done some very progressive things in Minnesota, and I do think that we should vote for people based on politics and not just simply vibes, although his vibes are also quite good.
I don't know if you saw the photo of him and his family. I saw a tweet that was like, Walz's family is Stanley Cup daughter and Discord son.
So Kamala picking Tim Walz did prompt our girl Cynthia Nixon to officially endorse via a coconut-themed reel.
We would play it for you, but we have to narrate, if you haven't seen this video, what's happening, because she's holding a coconut.
Like a coconut drink. Like she's drinking a piña colada.
It's the 360 remix with Kamala saying coconut, coconut, coconut. But Cynthia Nixon is so seductively looking at the camera.
Yeah, it's like borderline erotic for sure.
That I'm like, are you trying to seduce me? Like ask me to be a third? Or are you backing Walz? I don't know what's happening right now.
She's seducing us into voting in November.
Obviously, we've noted there is a vibe shift, and I've been trying to figure out what exactly it's been, because, Chelsea, if you remember, when Trump was shot, which was not even a month ago, we were like, oh, lights out, it's over, his re-election's in the bag, and now it seems like he's on the ropes.
And I kind of forgot that he was shot already, which is the more disturbing part.
The vibe shift is like, it's gone from the Democrats' message being this evocative dystopian reality of how like the world would be if Trump got re-elected to, I don't want to say hope, because that was Obama's thing, but like, maybe our darkest days are not ahead of us.
I don't think Obama is the only person that can use hope in their messaging.
I understand that, but things just seem better. It also feels like they've unmasked Trump. Like, it feels like Trump has been revealed to be the Wizard of Oz of like, oh, he's just a bumbling old man.
Well, he can't play the age card anymore.
He's kind of been out of the news cycle because, and I don't know if you've realized this, Chelsea, he stopped campaigning. He has not done a campaign event in a week.
Well, to be fair, he did just get shot, so... He went straight from getting shot to the RNC.
Well, when I texted you, I'm not used to Democrats like just having win after win. I think the other thing is they keep, at least for me, surprising the general audience that they have, like this amazing merch that they released a couple days ago, the camo hat.
I think we should talk about the merch more broadly. Did you see the other stuff?
It's not great.
It's very boring. Like, the logo does look like it was designed in like 10 minutes. That said, it is really neutral. Like, I wouldn't want to buy it necessarily, but I also wouldn't be embarrassed wearing it.
You're not a big fan of The Office. I'm not necessarily either, but the Harris Waltz merch and the font just reminds me of like Dunder Mifflin, which was the company in The Office. It's giving paper company in Scranton.
Yeah, the one piece of merch that they did quite a good job on was this camo hat, which is basically just a realistic camouflage print with the Harris Waltz logo embroidered in orange thread. It's not necessarily a unique design in the broader world of fashion, right? We've seen stuff like this in the streetwear world for over a decade now.
But that's its brilliance, right? It's the perfect distillation of the two candidates, because a camo hat is what coastal hipsters wear, ironically, but then it is worn earnestly by people who live in rural areas to hunt and shit.
Well, it's worn earnestly by Tim Walz. Like, in the video where she calls him and is like, hey, like, let's do this, he's wearing a camo hat, which is part of the reason why they did this.
So Taylor Lorenz reported that the team designed, developed, and had the hat up all within 5 hours. As people who do merch were very impressed by that. They initially made 3,000 hats. They all sold out in 30 minutes. The hats are now back ordered in the tens of thousands, and they sold $1 million in hats in the first day alone.
Look, it's not the worst idea to make merch that people actually want to wear. I do find it funny, though, that people are saying, oh my God, they ripped off Chapel Roan, who had a similar hat. And it's like, babes, you don't know how many people have done this before Chapel Roan. Like, I feel like Raf Simons was making shit that looked like this, like, literally 20 years ago. I associate it more with Heron Preston now, I suppose, but it's been a thing.
And so what? It's the summer of the Midwestern princesses.
I think now I associate these kind of realistic camo prints with that Praying brand. They're the people that make the shirts that say God's favorite.
Right.
I think this speaks to a more general trend, which is fashion conscious people, people that are interested in streetwear, wanting to dress like they shop at Walmart.
That's the true subversion.
Looking vaguely MAGA and appropriating that kind of look is kind of the only thing that really packs a punch at this point, because it is so controversial. Like, no one is shocked by someone that's dressed like a punk or someone that's wearing like a sheer dress or something at this point.
Yeah, I mean, it was bound to happen. There are historical examples of this. The Sex Pistols wearing swastikas. Like, it was bound to happen that fuckboys would start dressing like MAGA.
Yeah. All right, moving on. Shall we debut our new segment?
Absolutely. Let's play the theme.
On the Every Outfit podcast, fashion-based offenses are considered especially heinous. In Los Angeles, the degenerates who investigate these sartorial travesties are members of an elite squad known as the Fashion Victims Unit. These are their stories.
Guys, welcome to our inaugural Fashion Victims Unit segment. We have been doing this on our tour, but we thought we'd move it over to the podcast. This is our tribute to Joan Rivers and Mr. Blackwell. And today, our perp is none other than Miss Blake Lively.
There are some celebrities I reserve my judgment of their style, because I understand their style is not for me, but many people enjoy the way that they dress. And Blake Lively's style has never been my thing. I know people fuck with it, but these recent press looks and this Vogue cover has pushed me over the edge.
Do people actually like it, or is it a conspiracy? Because I think the media has been gaslighting us that Blake Lively is a fashion icon for years now. And now it's reached a fever pitch because she is promoting her new movie, It Ends With Us. Ryan Reynolds, of course, is promoting some horrible movie that I will never see.
Deadpool and Wolverine, co-starring Hugh Jackman. This will become important in a second.
Because In the film, It Ends With Us, she plays a woman that owns a flower shop. We are now in her floral era.
We're being sartorially waterboarded with floral prints and floral appliques.
It's a lot. It's too much. She's been wearing a lot of Chanel, a lot of Versace. These appear to be her preferred brands, but quite famously, she doesn't have a stylist.
I want to, before we move on, focus on the phrase quite famously, because while researching, many of the articles I read used the phrase famously. We all know Blake doesn't have a stylist. I'm like, I did not know that. It explains a lot.
Can we interrogate that a little bit, though? Sure, she may not have a big celebrity stylist. However, she is not the one that is dealing with DHL. She is not the one that is personally emailing the PR. If she doesn't have a stylist, it means that she has forced her assistant to do the outreach and the sort of logistical aspects of being a stylist, which is a massive part of that job. It's not just picking the clothes for someone.
Although many of the things she's worn are vintage, she's gotten from Tab Vintage. So I wonder if she's just on Instagram DMing Tab Vintage, being like, I'll have that, I'll have that.
I'm sure, and Tab is amazing. Don't want to bring them down in all of this drama. Tab is one of the best vintage dealers in Los Angeles. But yes, I do believe she's buying stuff from Tab, but she's also wearing current season Versace and Chanel and stuff. Stuff that is not bought from stores, stuff that is lent to her. Someone is facilitating that.
That's true.
When she says she doesn't have a stylist, it does not mean she does not have help with this, or I don't believe it. I want to see the receipts that she was the one on every single email with the Versace team making that crazy ass jumpsuit to wear to the Deadpool premiere.
Chelsea, don't you understand? She's Lady Deadpool, which she actually has a cameo as Lady Deadpool in Deadpool and Wolverine. So this is her nod to the Deadpool costume, but sexy.
I don't want to be too much of a bitch because on some level I recognize, like, this is not for me. And that goes beyond just fashion, right? That's Blake Lively's career in general. Like, I don't like anything that she's been in aside from Gossip Girl. And even then, I was more of a Blair than a Serena. And even then, I didn't even finish Gossip Girl.
You don't know that Dan is Gossip Girl?
Okay, I know that, but I didn't get to the end of Gossip Girl. And like, yeah, A Simple Favor was a fun movie. I will give it that. But the way the Vogue profile talks about A Simple Favor, you would think it was to catch a fucking thief. That's the thing that drives me insane, because not only is all media sort of positioning this woman as a style icon that is on par with Grace Kelly, this Vogue profile is gaslighting us into believing that she is somehow the last of the movie stars.
Simultaneously making her this ultra mom, totally relatable. And I was going to get into this in a little bit, but my hot take, Chelsea, and if I were ever on that Subway show where that guy asked what your hot take is, this would be mine. The worst thing that has happened to celebrity culture is celebrities feeling like they need to act like they are normal. Give me that old Hollywood distance. Give me that this celebrity is on a pedestal. Don't tell me that Blake is the every woman and she's the greatest mom and she just loves Betty Crocker, pre-made batter.
She adds her own bourbon and her own elderflower liqueur. Do not forget this.
Do we want to jump back to the press looks or jump into this Vogue issue?
I guess let's just wrap up the clothes, because I realized when I was looking at some of these outfits, it's like the clothes aren't even bad.
This is what helped me figure out, I think, my issue with Blake Lively's style, because all of the pics are good. I think it's her choice of how she's accessorizing these looks, or lack thereof. And I sent you a look that she pulled from Tab Vintage, which is an incredible Christian Dior Autumn Winter 1997 silk suit. Tab, of course, has what it looked like on the runway. And the styling is just so amazing, with a high neck top, pearls. And she has none of that, which is fine. But she's paired this beautiful archival Galliano Christian Dior silk skirt suit with a Chanel Camellia bag.
It's definitely not right. When I saw the photo of her in the vintage Versace dress that was famously worn by Britney Spears in the early 2000s, I had like a spooky moment where I realized, like, oh no, like, we're just sort of at the beginning of this archival fashion resurgence, and we've seen the best way that that can play out, right? Zendaya in the Thierry Mugler robot outfit. We've seen archival Balenciaga looks recreated for Nicole Kidman and Carey Mulligan. Now we are going to enter into an era of like celebrities I like less wearing clothes that I didn't like to begin with. Like, I didn't like that Britney Spears dress the first time around. The only thing that is cool about it is the fact that peak Britney Spears was wearing it at the height of her career, and we all love Britney so much.
Right.
And now I'm realizing, like, oh no, celebrities are going to see this, want to recreate it, because wearing the same dress as a celebrity instantly puts you in conversation with an iconic fashion moment. It's what Kim Kardashian did so effectively when she wore Marilyn Monroe's dress at the Met Gala. But I now see this becoming more and more of a trend, and I'm scared to see it snowball down to the depths of hell.
There's an authentic way to do it and an inauthentic way to do it. Obviously, Zendaya wearing the Thierry Mugler robot suit to the Dune premiere. She obviously loves fashion. We know that. It makes sense for the film. Blake Lively wearing the Britney Spears Versace dress is just a shortcut to have a talked about viral moment, because there's really no significance of her wearing this to the premiere exactly.
Look, I know we're being very cunty about Blake Lively, but I actually do like the fact that she is making her own outfits. I wish more celebrities would do this. I wish more celebrities would look crazy on their own terms, like a Britney Spears. Can we get into the Vogue photos, though?
Absolutely. I'll give you some stats. I don't know if you know this, Chelsea, but this is Blake's fourth Vogue cover. She was first on Vogue in February 2009. She was on the cover in June 2010, then August 2014. So she has not been on a Vogue cover in 10 years.
So she has more Vogue covers than good movies that she has been in. Well, what are your favorites?
She was good in The Town.
Okay.
From a PR and an Anna Wintour standpoint, this September issue makes sense, right? She's besties with everyone that's involved. Anna Wintour loves Blake Lively. She pals around with Hugh Jackman. They've been seen at the U.S. Open together. Anna Wintour was just at the Paris Olympic events with Baz Luhrmann. Blake Lively has a film coming out. Hugh Jackman was just, as I previously mentioned, in a monster smash film, Deadpool and Wolverine, with Blake Lively's husband, of which Blake has a cameo. Like, all of this makes sense, and yet I don't like any of it.
Well, also, Anna Wintour's allegiance to Baz Luhrmann is truly bizarre, just because, like, other directors do exist.
This editorial is loosely inspired by Hitchcock's To Catch a Thief, but it was not shot on location, Chelsea, but instead it was shot at Pier 59 with those volume LED screens that they've used for The Mandalorian, and I think they did it on the last Blade Runner as well. It's becoming more and more mainstream. The budgets are now so low for the September issue that they just have to basically project European backdrops in a studio in Chelsea.
It looks like AI. The backdrops of all of this don't look real at all. I am into a certain level of artifice, like as its own aesthetic. Like, I really love Inez and Vinood's early work because everything did look so fake and staged and plasticky. And I think there's a good way of doing that. But this is giving Midjourney.
Oh, it's next level, because it doesn't even look like Blake Lively and Hugh Jackman were in the same room together taking these photographs.
They probably weren't. Also, did you see the one photo where she's in the, like, Monte Carlo casino setup where she is wearing the Mike Todd ruby necklace?
Yes.
That was discussed in the Elizabeth Taylor documentary that we are about to get into.
Yes, indeed. Also, it looks like Morgan Spector, the hot guy from Gilded Age, is just in the background at the craps table for reasons unknown.
He should have his own full Vogue editorial as a love interest. He's so hot.
Also, this article does something that I do not love in fashion editorials, which is they use screenwriting slug lines and action like exterior, police car, night.
And also it's like the worst screenplay I've ever read. They did this more successfully in that issue of Vogue with Sarah Jessica Parker. They basically did a fake Sex in the City episode. which was pretty cute, actually.
I think the 2001-2002 issue that doesn't get enough coverage, but it's so cute. It's like Carrie Bradshaw goes to Isaac Mizrahi's studio and Oscar De La Renta's studio. I agree with you. I was about to mention that's the only time it's worked.
And I will say, I actually do love when a fashion editorial has a plot, like has a beginning, a middle, and end. I love it. I don't think people do it enough. So I'm not offended by that storytelling aspect of this. I just feel like it's incredibly cliche and not well executed. And who wants this?
It also doesn't make any sense because it's not To Catch a Thief. It's slightly inspired because, like, somehow Blake Lively is the Cat Burglar role and then also the Grace Kelly role, which are two separate characters in the film. So, like, either do the film or something different. Whatever this is, I don't like it. It's not working for me.
Yeah, and I really find the last movie star tone of the article to be bizarre. The last movie star is Angelina Jolie.
Well, I got one thing to say, Chelsea. I don't think we're going to be offered any Blake Brown anytime soon. God.
Don't even mention Blake Brown. I forgot about Blake Brown and all of this.
Blake Lively is launching her own hair care shampoo line called Blake Brown. I'd love to start with the product photography first, Chell, because I find it quite odd. I don't know if you've been to the website, but there's a photo where she's holding a comb like it's a phone. And I get it, like, you know, the thing where you hold a hairbrush like it's a phone, but not a comb.
I must have missed that.
So the whole concept of her hairline is that conditioner is trash and instead we should be using nourishing masks instead. That's what I've gleaned from this website.
Okay, at least that's a slightly different take. I think it's the worst packaging that I've ever seen for a celebrity brand.
Okay.
Even worse than Brad Pitt's skincare brand. And that's saying a lot. I was trying to isolate what this aesthetic is, and I've realized what it reminds me of, which is a bad dispensary. There is a whole genre in Los Angeles of these ugly dispensaries where they very much lean into the wood vibes of it all. They have logos that are quite similar to what the Blake Brown logo is. It's bad.
There's the couple Chip and Joanna Gaines who have a whole home renovation empire in Waco, Texas called Magnolia and Magnolia Home. And they're known for putting shiplap everywhere. So I call it a very shiplap Chip and Joanna Gaines aesthetic.
I think that's doing a disservice to Chip and Joanna Gaines. I think they're actually a lot better than this. I wouldn't even know that this was a product for women. I would assume it was for men, based on the way it looks.
This is from Blake Lively's shower to yours. Conceived by Blake Lively, crafted over 7 years with development experts in hair and fragrance, and loved by you. It's like, don't bring me into this. I haven't tried the product yet.
You could not pay me enough money to have that in my shower.
All right, shall we move into some movies and television?
Sure.
Can I run through some film and TV announcements, Chelsea?
What if I said no?
Then podcast over. We have to discuss. So Ben Affleck and Matt Damon are re-teaming for a film that is going to be about the Hulk Hogan Gawker lawsuit. Ben Affleck will be playing Hulk Hogan. Matt Damon will be playing Peter Thiel. Peter Thiel, who funded Hulk Hogan's lawsuit against Gawker because he was very upset that many years before, Gawker outed him. Not on Gawker, though, because I was researching this the other night. Remember Gawker had other websites? And their Silicon Valley-based one was called Valley Swag.
Okay, but it's part of their company.
No, for sure. But starting in 2011, like the Count of Monte Cristo, he was like, I'm going to fund other people's lawsuits so that I can get back at Gawker. And it finally worked with Hulk Hogan. The script is being written by the guy that did The Big Short. And most exciting to us, and why I'm bringing it up to you, is that Gus Van Sant will be directing.
God bless.
This man, for reasons unknown, has been in movie director jail.
He's been in Ryan Murphy jail.
So it's his first film in forever. I would imagine, given his filmography, this will be more in a To Die For tone.
One can only hope.
Ben Affleck with a shaved male pattern baldness look to be Hulk Hogan. Like, I don't even understand with prosthetics how he's going to look like him.
When I first heard that he was playing Hulk Hogan, I was like, I don't know how this is going to work. We already had The Wrestler. We already had that Zac Efron movie, whatever it's called.
Iron Claw, yes.
Like, how many prestige wrestler films do we need?
But now that we know that it's going to be a humorous, trashy...
tabloidy. Yeah, of course.
Yet artistic.
Always artistic. Also, we should mention this is a Good Will Hunting reunion.
Who knows if Casey Affleck and Cole Hauser will be in bit parts. Now, Chell, did you see the photo I sent you earlier this week of Ben Affleck's new divorce mohawk?
Yeah, when I saw that photo, I felt empathy because you have to be in a lot of pain to do a taxi driver look in your 50s.
Yeah, when I saw the photo, I was like, oh, he's getting divorced. Got it.
Because it wasn't just the faux hawk. It was like the Red Hot Chili Peppers shirt. It looked like the Red Hot Chili Peppers shirt you would get from Hot Topic, or like if you Googled like Red Hot Chili Pepper t-shirt, that would come up. It's not like a cool one is what I'm saying. Like, he's not spending like $500 at the best vintage t-shirt dealer getting this shirt.
No, he went into one of his children's closets and got their Hot Topic Red Hot Chili Pepper shirt.
Although the combination of the tee and the faux hawk was kind of reminding me of recent Junya Watanabe collections.
Would love to see him in some Junya.
He should just steer it more in that direction.
So, some sad news. David Lynch recently did an interview with Sight and Sound magazine where he said that he could no longer direct in person because of his emphysema diagnosis and his fear of getting COVID on set because of his lung condition. So he is stepping back from live directing. Although, knowing David Lynch, he could be the first director to Zoom direct, honestly.
That's not ideal, though. I talked to a friend of mine who's an art director who has been art directing shoots in Europe over Zoom.
That's rough for two reasons. Because the Zoom of it all, but also the time difference. Not great.
Yeah, exactly. You got to wake up in the middle of the night for that shit.
Well, I'll always hold dear to my heart. As you know, Chelsea, my previous place was by David Lynch's house. And there was that moment where I looked out my window and Kyle MacLachlan and Laura Dern were embracing while getting into their cars.
That's so crazy.
So it was announced that John M. Chu, who directed Crazy Rich Asians, he's also the director behind the upcoming Wicked film, will be directing a Britney Spears biopic. Don't know if we need it.
See, to me, when I think about adapting Britney's life story, it should be psychological horror, right?
Sure, a certain part of her early 20s, for sure.
Is there a world where a Lynn Ramsey, an Ari Aster, perhaps?
So Joaquin Phoenix is Kevin Federline?
Why not?
I hope this becomes like the, what I assume is the still doomed Madonna biopic, where they announce it and then it just sort of never happens. It fizzles out. Although I hear that maybe that Madonna written and directed Julia Garner biopic is still happening.
I hope so. Look, I do love Crazy Rich Asians. I don't know if I'm a super fan of his other movies. He did do those Justin Bieber documentaries, so maybe he understands like the profound sadness of being a pop star on that level.
Yeah, I mean, there's obviously a part of her story that is very dark, and it seems that he directs films that are much lighter. So it's going to be interesting how they choose to handle the conservatorship of it all, and obviously the shaving her head. Or is it going to be from youth to like it ends at the Lucky video or something? Does the biopic end on a high of her MTV performance kissing Madonna or something?
See, now that I'm thinking about this, I feel like it should be somewhere between Bo is Afraid and the David LaChapelle video for Every Time.
But the director's cut where she does die.
No. Okay, maybe that's too dark.
Sorry, guys. Who would be in the film?
Who's playing Britney? Sydney Sweeney?
Millie Bobby Brown? Moving on, the full cast of Ryan Murphy's upcoming Hulu drama All's Fair has been announced. This is, of course, the Kim Kardashian as Laura Wasser law show. Sarah Paulson, Niecy Nash-Betts, and Naomi Watts and Tiana Taylor have been added to the cast. So do we think Naomi Watts or Sarah Paulson or maybe Niecy Nash is replacing the Halle Berry role? Remember, because Halle Berry was announced And then like a week later, she was like, I'm out.
Who knows? But all of these people are already in the Ryan Murphy universe, except for Teyana Taylor. Has she been in a Ryan Murphy thing?
Not that I'm aware of.
Also, I've been hearing around town that the wardrobe budget is like insane. And they very much are trying to make this like Sex and the City in the sense that the characters are on the cutting edge of fashion, which is exactly what they should be doing, frankly.
Fucking bless.
Let's go.
Kim Kardashian recently got a restraining order against Emma Roberts' stalker because Emma Roberts let her know that her stalker, Melvin Jeffrey Coney, had come to her house looking for Kim. Very spooky.
Don't like that.
HBO and Max released a preview showing the previews of shows to come the rest of this year and into 2025, which gave us our first look at White Lotus Thailand and Just Like That season 3.
But a very brief look.
Yes, I feel like we got more White Lotus than certainly and Just Like That. It was more just the girls walking.
Well, also, we had already seen paparazzi images of those scenes. White Lotus, we hadn't seen anything. I think they released a couple photos a while back, but first time we're seeing Parker Posey in motion.
The, you know, Soderbergh yellow Mexico tint that they've given the footage for Thailand, not thrilled about.
Also, this made me realize, like, damn, Max has so many shows that I don't watch. I'm now realizing that the ones I actually do watch are just White Lotus, Gilded Age, and Just Like That, Last of Us I watched. Also, Catherine O'Hara is on The Last of Us. That was my big takeaway from this Max promo.
Yes. Well, it's HBO and Max because some of these shows are actually on HBO. But who watches HBO anymore? We just go to Max. Yeah. Will you be watching The Last of Us season 2 now that you know Catherine O'Hara will be on?
Look, I'm already invested.
Did you watch season 1?
Yes.
Oh, I didn't know that about you. Okay.
You didn't, though. Or you started to and you didn't care.
The one oddly nerd shit thing, I was like, nah, I'm good.
Look, what Max is really excelling at is documentaries about actresses that we love.
That's true. Give me more. Give me all of the lost tapes of actresses as documentaries set to archival footage. I will watch every single one of them.
Absolutely.
We are, of course, talking about the recently released documentary, Elizabeth Taylor, The Lost Tapes.
Yes, and these lost tapes in question were tapes that were recorded by a journalist named Richard Merriman, who had been recording conversations with Elizabeth Taylor spanning from what?
It's hard to say if this was not just a few sessions in the 1960s where she started talking about her life or if it spanned over decades. I'm not sure.
Because once it got to like the 70s, they were kind of like done with her.
I paused it because I was like, wow, I know this documentary is only an hour and 41 minutes. Like, are we going to get to like the back end of her life? And I was like, oh, no, we're running out of time.
No, it does a good job of covering Elizabeth Taylor when she's at the height of her career and the height of her scandals, the 40s, the 50s, the 60s. Then it just kind of drops off. I think that our criticism of most limited series is typically this should be a movie and not a limited series, but this actually should be a limited series and not a movie.
Right, absolutely.
Although I understand if the tapes weren't there, they weren't there, so.
They fill out her later years with this tape conversation with Dominic Dunn from 85 that explains her leaving the world of acting and starting a charity and all of her, the amazing work she did for AIDS research. It doesn't exactly get into the fact that she basically forced President Ronald Reagan to use the word AIDS since she knew him when he was an actor.
But see, if this was a limited series, there would be a whole AIDS episode.
Absolutely.
Okay, she was the oldest looking teenager. What the actual fuck?
Well, I also gasped when she was talking about making Virginia Woolf and she was like, well, I was 32. And I was like, what? I know she gained weight and put prosthetics, but it was like, you've been married 4 times and you're 32?
I know. It's super crazy. I think when I saw Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, I don't know if it was when I was in my late teens or early 20s, but I was certainly of an age where I didn't understand the lineage of her career. It didn't occur to me that the math isn't mathing, like in terms of her age and the fact that that was movie was released in the late 60s.
The revelation for me in this documentary, I knew she was a child actress, but at 16 and she looks 27. She's playing the wife of like some 50-year-old actor.
Yeah, the fact that there was no transition from child roles to adult roles is truly crazy. Also, the fact that when she was in Giant, she was playing a 52-year-old woman and the woman playing her daughter was older than her.
It was 2 years older than her. But the actress that played her daughter did look younger than Elizabeth Taylor, even with Elizabeth Taylor in old lady makeup and a gray wig. The other thing that I got from this documentary was I did not realize Mike Todd was the love of her life, because my understanding of Mike Todd primarily comes from the Carrie Fisher one-woman show Wishful Drinking, where she explains how her parents, Eddie Fisher and Debbie Reynolds, were best friends with Elizabeth Taylor and Mike Todd. And when Mike Todd tragically died in a plane crash, Eddie went to go comfort her, as Carrie Fisher says, with his penis, which I just kept reciting as I was watching the documentary as a slow car crash, as Debbie Reynolds is talking about her idea of like, let's send Eddie to comfort Elizabeth. She can't be alone at this time. And in my head, I'm like, with his penis.
And yes, Debbie was represented in the documentary in voiceover form. That just seemed like such a dark and fucked up situation. I guess that's true of a lot of her love life, certainly the marriage to Nikki Hilton, which was abusive. In this documentary, she does talk about the fact that he kicked her in the stomach so that she'd have a miscarriage. So much fucked up shit.
It makes sense in the context of her life. As she said, you know, she went from the set to her parents' home to her first husband's home. She got married when she was 18. And you do, if you could go back and like hug her, you just kind of want to be like, you could date someone. You don't always have to marry them.
Well, clearly that's not a lesson that she was willing to learn in her life. I didn't realize that she married Eddie Fisher 3 hours after his divorce came through. He couldn't even be single for a day.
This is also covered in the Carrie Fisher Wishful Drinking. They also really gloss over the fact that her and Richard Burton were married twice.
The timeline of the marriages gets a little more muddled towards the end once we get into the 70s and all of that, which is my favorite Elizabeth Taylor era, of course, because she was a bit washed up at the time. She was wearing a lot of fabulous caftans. She was doing really great campy movies like Boom, like The Driver's Seat, X, Y, and Z. Like, this is my favorite Elizabeth Taylor, personally.
You would like a whole episode dedicated to this.
The Hollywood Babylon 2 Elizabeth Taylor is where it's at.
I don't know that much about her filmography, so I was unaware until this documentary how much she hated the film Butterfield 8, of which she won an Oscar for.
Yeah, her whole thing is that movie sucked. My performance wasn't that good. Everyone just felt bad that I had a tracheotomy.
While she was shooting Cleopatra, she had terrible pneumonia, went to the hospital. They had to stop filming and then
almost died.
Won an Oscar then for Butterfield 8. I hate the dialogue. I sound like a fucking idiot.
Well, you get the sense that she really hated working in the studio system. She hated the kinds of roles that she was getting. She wanted to be seen as a capital A actress.
It's frankly shocking that she was able to get out of the schlock she was doing and make actually good films, because this is, yes, she was an actress in and then out of the traditional Hollywood system, where she began her career where literally the studio executives are telling her what film she could be in. Before that broke down, agents took over and you had a little bit more autonomy with your career. But she was the first performer, actor, or actress to be paid $1 million, which was for Cleopatra.
Worth it, clearly.
Which tomorrow you and I will be going to the Century City Westfield to see the movie Trap. And we wouldn't have Century City if not for the film Cleopatra, because the studio had to sell off their backlot land to be able to fund the film.
And that's where the mall is?
Yeah. Century City is where 20th Century Fox, I believe.
Oh, that's why it's called that. Yeah, I think I also just wanted some acknowledgement of the period where it's like she lost all the weight to like an extreme degree and then was in the Flintstones.
That's right. Well, we didn't get, you know, her illustrious perfume career either.
Oh, yeah. That's crazy.
No, what was it? White Diamonds?
Yeah.
This was White Diamonds erasure.
I bought a bottle of it once because I was Elizabeth Taylor for Halloween, and I had like a clear acrylic clutch with a bottle of white diamonds in it.
I remember this. Yeah.
Also, we need to rewatch Wishful Drinking. It's been years, and I was thinking about it this week because I rewatched Postcards from the Edge, and fuck, that is a good movie.
Carrie Fisher and Natasha Richardson are like the two celebrity deaths. Oh, and Robin Williams, of course. Those are the three celebrity deaths that really affect me. I think about several times a year. It's why I will never ski.
Well, Natasha Richardson really gets to me during Love Actually season. Also skiing season, coincidentally.
For the few of you who may not know this story, in the early 2010s, Natasha Richardson, who was married to Liam Neeson, went skiing, fell, had a bit of a headache. Turns out she had a hemorrhage, didn't get checked out, was dead by the next day. It's why I will never ski. It makes me very sad.
Will never ski. That and I'm lazy.
And I also, at this point, because I've never learned to ski, I fear that when I try, I will break my leg. So Paul has indicated, as has Tat, that they would love to go snowboarding. So, like, I think we should do an every outfit trip to, like, Mammoth or something where you and I stay inside and record and they go snowboard.
I mean, do we have to record? Can't we just, like, sit by the fire and drink hot toddies or something?
That's true. But how is it going to be a business expense if we don't record?
Point taken.
Speaking of which, we need to wrap things up because Chelsea and I are going to go get our nails done.
We haven't had them done since the wedding, and they look disgusting because we both have, like, Gel X, like, fake nails, basically, that have now grown out to such an extreme degree that it looks disgusting.
Well, it also took us an embarrassingly long time to realize that both of our partners do not have the nail needs that we do, as we both get these, yes, extensions on our nails, that we should just coordinate our visits to the lovely Butter Nails. So that's where we must go, guys.
Yeah, we gotta bounce, but thank you guys for listening as always.
And we'll be back next week.
Bye.
Love you guys. Bye.